Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of analysis of our jobs, our incomes, our economic futures, the debts we have, the educations for our kids we have to pay for, all of those kinds of aspects of the economic system we live in. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for truthout.org, an independent and courageous source of analysis and news available to you every day. truthout.org. I maintain two websites where I collect interesting materials that expand on the topics we cover in these programs and that also provide you with leads and connections to pursue your own interests in these areas. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the other one is democracyatwork, all one word, .info, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Those websites also provide you with ways to communicate to us what you like and don't like about the program, topics you'd like us to cover, questions you'd like us to answer. We look at every single email we get, and we use them to shape the contents of these programs. And finally, both websites provide you with icons to click on if you'd like to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. And needless to say, we invite you, we urge you to follow us in that way and to keep abreast with what we're doing and the kinds of analysis we provide. I want to begin with a remarkable update today. And here I make use of and I'm grateful to acknowledge the work of Elise Gould. She works with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And on June 11th, she produced a report. Perhaps tongue-in-cheek, she said that in honor of Father's Day, she was going to take a look at what has happened to the wages of men who work between the ages of 25 and 34 on the one hand, and between the ages of 35 and 44. These, of course, are the ages when most men become fathers in this society and indeed in most societies. And the question she asked was this: how did the workers fare in those childbearing ages when they became fathers back in 1979 and then again in 2013? How did the 34 intervening years affect the economic situation faced by fathers? And I thought the results were extremely interesting and significant. Here's how she tabulated her results. What percentage of the men in those ages, in the 2 years, earned above and what percent earned below poverty-level wages? So, for example, in 2013, the official poverty-level wage was $11.45. So she measured the equivalent. And here are her findings, and I want you to think about them with me, please. First, in 1979, looking at the younger half group, the men in the ages 25 to 34, 10.8% earned below poverty wages. That is, they worked a regular full-time job, but it ended up leaving them in poverty because the wages were so low. In 1979, 10.8% of men were in that situation, men in the ages 25 to 34. How did men in that same age group, young men starting families, how did they do in 2013? What percentage of them working full-time earned below poverty wages? 26.1%. In other words, the percentage of young fathers living in poverty, even though they worked full-time, more than doubled over the last 34 years. When we look at the story for men in the ages 35 to 44, here's what we find. Back in 79, 7.6% of them earned wages that landed them in poverty. And in 2013, 15.4%. Again, more than a doubling of the number of young men, fathering men, living in poverty. Now, these numbers are absolutely staggering. If I had time, I'd compare them to women. Women's situation improved. That is, the percentage of those living in poverty, earning poverty wages, which is higher than that of men, nonetheless got lower over the last 34 years. Women's position, while worse than men, that is, the number of them earning below poverty level wages, it's worse than men's, but it got better. The men's, not as bad as the women's, got much, much worse. What does that tell us? It tells us that young men facing the decision to have children, facing the responsibilities of fatherhood, particularly early in the children's lives, the part when much of what happens to you as an adult is shaped in your first 5 years, that we are putting more and more of our children into the situation that the family they are born into has a father and a mother that are earning poverty-level wages, and that that situation has gotten consistently and seriously worse over the last period of time. It means that we are condemning young people and our children, the children of those young people, to more and more of a poverty lifestyle, of a poverty set of conditions. This was going on before this crisis hit, and it's continuing during this crisis. We are making the conditions of our population, of more and more of it, very, very economically depressed and difficult. And we will be living with the social consequences of a system that's doing this for generations to come. Another update for today takes us back, as we often do, to the city of Detroit. Because again, Detroit, as I have said to you, and we said it last week as well, is our future unless we make basic changes in our economy and our society. This week, I want to report on an agreement that was reached when the Board of Detroit's General Retirement System, that's the system that provides pensions for former city workers. Here's what they agreed to. This board agreed with the courts, because remember, Detroit is in a bankruptcy procedure, which means everything that happens economically in Detroit has to be okayed by a judge in a court procedure because they've declared the bankruptcy of the city. Here's what the board representing the interests of the retirees agreed to. A basic pension cut of 4.5%, right? Basically, $1 in $20 that had been promised to public employees, that had money had been taken from their salaries to fund their pensions, $1 in $20 of the pensions they were supposed to get, they've just agreed to forego, to do without. Why? Because the judge and the bankruptcy proceeding threatened that if they didn't agree to 4.5%, the judge might eventually decide on a final bankruptcy arrangement that would cut their pensions significantly more than that. In short, they were threatened, and they decided to take what they hoped was the lower amount they would be faced with, 4.5%, than to risk a larger amount. Okay, what's going on here? Detroit is bankrupt. That is because Detroit declared that it owed significantly more money than it was able to raise, more money than it had. Now, why is that? One basic reason is that Detroit, for many years, chose not to tax big corporations and chose not to tax wealthy citizens anywhere near the levels that both corporations and wealthy people had been taxed in the past by the federal, state, and local governments. They chose that. Their local political leaders chose that. Now, having not taxed corporations and the rich who had the money, having chosen not to do that, they declared bankruptcy. And that in turn is now going to be resolved by not giving to the former city workers one out of the $20 that they paid for, that they agreed to in legal contracts between city workers and the city. The cost of not taxing the wealth of the rich will be paid for by cutting the pensions of former public employees. I don't mean to be an alarmist, but I would be derelict in my duty to you on this program if I did not say that every American citizen, whether he or she works for the city, the state, or the federal government, must pay attention. If a pension commitment that was thought to be protected not only by contract law, but literally in this case by the Constitution of the state of Michigan, which has in it a clause about the sanctity of pension commitments, if all of that is so much empty language, so many documents that don't really count, then whose pension is safe? Which among you, whether you are currently getting a pension or you think you will get one in the future, can avoid to face that we're in an economic system that not only periodically plunges us into wasteful loss of jobs and income, but seeks to solve the problems of a system that works this way by cutting the pensions of people who gave a lifetime of work and made the contributions to fund the pensions for their old age. If you needed a criticism of the system, this decision, reluctantly entered into by the pensioners of Detroit, speaks volumes of criticism. The next update is about the state of Missouri, a state in which I spent a portion of my own childhood, Columbia, Missouri, and so I know it quite well. But it did something over the last week that I think deserves your attention and a few minutes of our program's time. Governor Jay Nixon, a Democrat, last Wednesday vetoed 10 tax break bills that he said would jeopardize the state budget. He spoke of it costing the state $425 million, and he basically made a classic argument that we're in a time of economic difficulty, that the economic difficulty affects Missouri like it does most states, that the government is called upon to help people during this time of difficulty rather more than normal, so it is a peculiarly inappropriate time to take away from the state $425 million that it needs to perform the functions, particularly now, that people need more than ever because of the crisis. I wanted to let you know, however, what these tax cut bills were, pushed mainly by the Republicans, and in this case, vetoed by the sitting Governor Jay Nixon. Here they are. All of these bills provided tax breaks for the following: computer data centers, power companies, restaurants, fitness centers, farmers markets, commercial laundries, and this one I really liked, people who buy old vehicles. Now, this list should teach you what most tax cutting is about. It's about providing special benefits to special interests who have the political clout to get a bill through the legislature that gives them a special break. No matter, they don't care what problems this creates for the state government. All of this is couched in lingo that says if you give a cut to these companies, to these enterprises, it will produce more jobs. Most of the time it doesn't. None of the time is there ever any measurement. You go to try to figure out what the results of this thing were, you discover that nobody keeps any records because it's just BS. It's the veneer to get through the legislature a bill that makes everybody have a harder time with state government funding while the beneficiary of the bill gets a lower tax bill at the end of the year, more profits to keep for them to use or not use as they see fit. The tax-cutting mania is a hustle. It is mainly pushed by the people who want the special benefit. And then the government can't do what it's supposed to do and makes everybody angry or has to go raise taxes. But it starts with the crazy way this system works, in which private enterprises go into the state to get special benefits. Let's turn now, as we often do in our program, to major topics that often have been suggested by you in your comments to us. And I'm going to do next something I do occasionally when I think there's been a publication of a book that is so interesting by a person who knows what he or she is talking about that I want to discuss it a little bit with you. This is a new book. The author is Stephen Roach, R-O-A-C-H, for many years a banker with the Morgan Stanley Bank in New York, one of the largest banks in the United States, and currently in his semi-retirement, a professor at Yale University. The title of his recently published book is called Unbalanced: The Codependency of America and China. And I want to talk to you about his basic thesis and then make some comments of my own. So first, his idea is this. The United States and China have been like two demonic dancers, grasping each other as they move around the dance floor, needing to lift and move with one another for the dance to work. For each of them to get the benefits of dancing, each has to play his role in relationship to that of the other. But they have become, in their interaction, codependent in the way that that is meant, for example, in the medical community. Unhealthy, their dependence on each other becoming burdensome, even though they kind of have to hold on. It's as though the dancers were exhausted and needed to separate, but neither one knew how without offending the other one or causing the both of them to fall to the floor in a clumsy display. So they hang on way beyond it's good for either of them, and eventually, when they do finally fall apart, both will be severely damaged in the process. They hung together too long. They became not partners, but codependent on one another. That's the idea. And Mr. Roach believes it's the situation that now connects China and America. He also believes that China is going to break out of that codependency pretty soon, and that that raises major problems for the United States, if indeed China does that. So let's explore this together for a moment. First, how is China dependent on the United States? And then we'll ask the question in reverse, how is the United States dependent on China? The dependence of China on the United States is obvious and clear. China has gone, in an unbelievably short time by historical standards, basically 25, 30 years, has gone from a largely poor, backward, agrarian economy with an enormous population to a modern industrial powerhouse, now recognized to be the second most important industrial country in the world after the United States, growing much, much faster than the United States. For example, over the last couple of years, China's growth has averaged above 8%. Ours has been in the neighborhood of 1% or 2%. I mean, not even close. So the United States is being gained on by China. In this situation, this industrialization, China is dependent on the United States. Why? Because the bulk of what China's industries produce are purchased by citizens and companies in the United States. China could not have grown without selling all of that output in the United States. The United States is the market, not the only market, but the major market, the richest market. It has absorbed Chinese goods on an incredible scale. We're going to have more to say about that in a minute or two. But China's industrialization, China's growth, China's success, China's wealth have crucially depended on being able to sell at a profitable price the vast bulk of what has come out of its rapidly growing industries. The second way, closely associated with the first, that China's economic development has been dependent on the United States, is that American companies have poured huge amounts of capital into China. That is, usually in partnership with the Chinese companies, they have invested in, built huge factories, huge storage facilities, transportation facilities, marketing facilities, so that the goods they produced in China with this capital could be achieved. China alone did not have the money, did not have the capital to pay for building all of that industrial infrastructure. So the United States companies poured money there, often moving production from the United States to China as part of this process. So China dependent on the United States for capital and especially for markets. Now let's look at the other side of the codependency. The United States dependent on China. How'd that work? Well, the first and most important dependency of the United States on China was the dependency of American corporations on the incredible flow over the last 25 years of inexpensive Chinese products. Clothing, textiles in general, small appliances, medium appliances, furniture, pots and pans, bigger appliances, more developed technology, capital goods, machine. It's unbelievable. And why do I say the U.S. was dependent? The U.S. was dependent because American companies were able to get cheaper machines by buying from China than they would have had to pay if they had bought them anywhere else. But even more important than that, companies in the United States were able not to give their workers wage increases, and yet the workers didn't complain. And one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons American workers didn't complain much more than they might have when their wages stopped going up was that they were able to get a higher standard of living because the prices they had to pay were going down, particularly the prices for clothing and the prices for small appliances, as they literally moved from paying higher prices for those goods when they were made in the United States or elsewhere and substituting cheaper goods imported from China. So it allowed corporations to make more profits than they otherwise could because they could pay lower wages, which American workers accepted because the wages not going up still allowed them to buy more goods and services, particularly clothing, appliances, furniture, and so on, because the prices of those things was dropping thanks to China. So the whole profit structure of the United States, the whole wage payments imposed on capitalists in the United States were positively affected by the flood of ever cheaper Chinese goods. And that includes computers, parts for computers, automobiles, parts for automobiles, on and on and on. So American capitalism became dependent on cheap consumer goods, cheap capital goods, cheap components coming from China. And China depended on flooding the American market with the products of the goods produced in China with a good bit of help from American corporations. Finally, the Chinese made the United States dependent on them in yet another way. And this has to do with what the Chinese did with all the money they got from selling all those products in the United States. They got lots and lots of dollars for selling those goods here in the United States. What did they do with those dollars? If they had taken those dollars and converted them back into their own currency, they would have depressed the value of the dollar because you're dumping all these dollars, you're selling them, and they would have driven up the price of Chinese currency because they were exchanging dollars for currency. They were selling dollars to buy Chinese currency. Had they done that, it would have raised the value of the Chinese currency, the yuan, relative to the dollar, and that would have made it more expensive for Americans to buy Chinese goods. They didn't want that to happen. So they didn't convert the dollars into their own currency. What did they do? They lent those dollars. This is the important thing to understand to Uncle Sam. The Chinese used the dollars they earned from flooding the American market with their goods, by buying the national debt of the United States, lending the money to Uncle Sam. Over the last 10 years, Uncle Sam has borrowed more than in any 10-year period, perhaps other than World War II. To stimulate our economy in the Great Crisis, the government borrowed huge, over $1 trillion a year for several years. The government borrowed vast amounts of money. The Chinese were the major, single major lender to the United States government. Money borrowed to fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Money borrowed to stimulate the American economy. The Chinese provided a huge portion of that. If the Chinese had not provided that money, Uncle Sam would have had to get it somewhere else, and he would have had to pay higher interest rates. And if Uncle Sam has to pay higher interest rates to get money, so does everybody else. And that would have made our economic situation, for all of us, much worse. It would have made us pay more in car payments. It would have had to pay more in mortgage payments, because those are affected by interest rates. So the Chinese, providing all those trillions of dollars to the United States government in loans, made the United States dependent. That's why we have that stunning statistic today, that the single largest creditor of the United States, that is, the single largest lender to the United States, the country to which the United States owes more money than to any other, is the People's Republic of China. The United States is the largest debtor country in the world. That is, no other country owes that much to other countries than the United States. And the largest creditor country in the world is the People's Republic of China. The largest capitalist country is the world's biggest debtor, and the largest communist country is the world's biggest creditor. I'm not going to say more, but it's something for you to think about. Let's return to Mr. Roach's book. Where's the trouble in this codependency? In other words, okay, we can now see how the United States has benefited from the relationship with China, and we can see how the Chinese have benefited with the relationship with the United States. Where's the problem? Answer. The Chinese, Roach says, and he has been a specialist in China for the Morgan Stanley Bank for much of his adult life. So this is a man who knows, which is why I'm talking about his book as opposed to other books on China. Stephen Roach thinks that the Chinese are determined to reduce their dependency on the United States. They want out of this relationship. They think they've gone about as far as they can go being a producer of industrial goods for export. Export to the United States, export to Western Europe particularly. So they're doing everything they know how to shift their economy, to become in a way more like the United States, where more of the product, the produce of China, the output, is sold to other Chinese, that the domestic market becomes much more important, relatively, to the foreign market. So they become more dependent on themselves, you might say, and less dependent on the rest of the world, particularly and preeminently the United States. And at the same time, they want to become less dependent on the United States for capital, the other way they're dependent. They want to make more deals with Europeans, with countries in the Middle East that have a lot of money, and so forth. They want to become more multilateral in their international relationships and less dependent on the United States. So, for example, they do not want to become a major purchaser of energy, oil, gas, and so on, from the United States. They're working very hard to make deals with other countries rather than the United States. Final point. Roach wants us to worry, because he's worried, that if the Chinese do that, if they're successful, it's going to pose huge problems for the United States. And the problems are precisely those that flow out of the codependency. Number one, the prices of Chinese goods will go up because they're no longer manipulating the currency the way I described to you, and they're no longer focused on keeping the prices of their goods terribly low to make it into foreign markets. They're willing to let their prices rise by giving their workers higher wages. In recent years, the wages of the Chinese workers have risen much faster, say, than wages of workers in the United States, which have hardly budged. So with wages rising in China, we can expect prices to rise in China, and Americans are not going to see the kinds of price declines that the last 20 years were full of. And that's going to make workers have a new problem. They're going to have to demand more wages from American employers because they are seeing their prices of Chinese and other goods rising. Now, some producers are leaving China and going to Vietnam and other countries to try to hold on to low prices. But what's happened in China is going to happen there, too. And so we're going to see a squeeze here in the United States as workers discover their standard of living isn't going up because prices of commodities are not going down. And the problem for America will be that China is using its capital in new and different ways, and they don't need American capital the way they did. To make a long story short, the United States faces adjustment problems because its codependency with China is reaching a point of basic change, just like other things are bringing basic change to the American economy. We're going to take our mid-program break now. Please stay with me. We will be back in a matter of seconds. This is Richard Wolff, and the program is Economic Update. Welcome back, friends. This is Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, and as always, we do after the mid-program break. I want to remind you of the two websites we maintain and encourage and invite you to take a look at them. They're available to you on the internet 24/7, no charge whatsoever. The first one is rdwolff.com, rdwolff, all one word, rdwolff.com, and the other one, democracyatwork.info. Both of these websites contain materials like what you get on this program, expanding it, sometimes into a lecture, sometimes into an entire class that lasts a semester. As much of this as you're interested in, it's all there for your use and for your interest. In addition, if you go to these websites, you can send us a communication, an email, that lets us know what you like and don't like, what you'd like us to discuss on this program, how you'd like us to proceed. We read each and every one, and we use them to shape this program. Finally, both websites allow you to click on an icon if you wish to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Pinterest. And of course, we urge and invite you to do so. Our second major topic today in economics, and I apologize in advance, this is going to be a little bit like a classroom, but from time to time, that's not a bad thing, and it's what I'm pretty good at because I've done it all my life, so I thought I would indulge it, and several of you have asked for it. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about how an economic system as a whole works, why it breaks down, basically, our particular capitalist economic system, and what then becomes the issue about how to respond to the breakdown. I'm going to do for the economy as a whole a little bit what an auto mechanic might do if you brought in a car that had repeatedly not worked for you just when you needed to get from here to there. Okay, let's begin. In order for most people in any economy to earn money nowadays, to earn an income, the goods or services that they help to produce have to be sold. Let me give you a simple example. If you work in a car factory, the only way the employer can pay you your wage is if that employer is able to sell the car you help to produce. If you work in a hair salon, the only way that the owner of the hair salon can pay you your salary is if folks come in there and buy haircuts, hair color changes, and all the rest of the things that hair salons do. Likewise, if you earn rent from some manufacturer, he can only pay you rent for the land you own if he's able to sell whatever the products are he makes in the factory that sits on the land he rents from you, and so on. So the simple point here is that for each of us to earn our income, our wage, our salary, our rent, our profits, whatever, the people of our society have to buy the goods that we help to produce with our labor, with our land, with our loans, whatever we give to the production process. It pays us only if and when the producer can sell what we help to produce, just the way it works. But here comes the interesting part. In order for us to earn our income, the owner of the enterprise we work for, if we're a worker, which is what most people are, has to sell the output. But the buyers of the output, it's us again. In other words, an economy is a peculiar circular flow. We only earn income because we all spend our money. And we only all spend our money because we earn it. And indeed, an economy is healthy and functioning if the people who earn the money turn around and spend it because they only earned it because they spend it. And if they want to keep earning it, they've got to keep spending it. The money, in a sense, goes around and around. And you've all noticed that because the dollar you get when it's new then becomes crinkled and wrinkled and old and bent and eventually gets replaced by a new one because that dollar keeps moving around and around, or that euro keeps moving around and around. It is moving from the buyer to the income receiver, who turns around and spends it, making somebody else's income, who turns around and spends it, and so the system works. That is, it works so long as everybody who earns an income turns around and spends it. Well, I think you can already now see where the problem arises. The problem in such an economy arises if an income earner takes some of the money earned and doesn't spend it. Think of it in the simplest terms. Suppose you normally earned some money, and one of your enjoyments was to go bowling. And you took your income, a part of it, and you went to the local bowling establishment, and you paid some money to be enabled to indulge your enjoyment in bowling. When you paid money to bowl, you were making income for the bowling establishment, which could then use it to pay the workers in that establishment, etc. If you decided, which in our economic capitalist system you're free to do, if you decide to break with your pattern, to take the money you used to spend on bowling and not spend it anymore, not on bowling, not on anything, save it, you produce actually an ironic economic problem for other people. You don't mean to. You intend no harm, but harm you do. In this case, you're harming the bowling establishment. It built that establishment on the assumption and hope you would come. The workers there depend for their income on people like you coming. When you choose not to spend your money, you're plunging the bowling establishment into difficulty. If several people do it at the same time, the bowling establishment will collapse. None of those people intended the bowling establishment any harm. But our interdependent economy, the circular flow that connects us to everybody else, whether we know them or not, is an iron reality of our economic system. So here's what happens. In every economic system like ours, individuals choose to save money. They're free to, and some do. Most don't, because most don't earn enough to allow them to save. The majority of people in most capitalist societies do not save. But let's take a look at those who do. Most of them put their money in the bank. That's where they save it. And there's an interesting institution, the bank, because what the bank does with the money some of us save and put into it is lend it to other people who then spend it. Businesses borrow to expand their businesses. Other people borrow for their own consumption, whether it be for a credit card or to buy a car or to buy a home, etc. So much of the savings of working people, the middle and lower classes of most societies, much of that saving doesn't cause any problem because the bank works as an agency, an institution that takes the savings some people have and lends it to other people who will spend the money. Since what we need for the circular flow to continue is for the money to be spent, our system is okay if the money saved that goes into the banks is matched by money flowing out of the banks into the hands of borrowers who will spend it. So now comes the difficulty. What happens if there are folks who spend much less, who decide to save a great deal, put it in the bank, but there aren't enough borrowers to pull it out of the bank? Then the money isn't spent. It sits in the bank. Can that happen? Yes. Does it happen? Yes. And the big question, the one I want you to think about, is who does this? Where does the problem lie? And the answer here is crystal clear. The only entities, the only people, the only groups in our society that significantly save money, that is, take a major portion of their income and choose not to spend it, are wealthy people and corporations, businesses. The business is always thinking about saving. Why? Because if a business thinks that the economy is not in good shape, it makes no sense to go to the bank, borrow money to expand your business, and then have unsellable product. So if a company thinks things are not looking good, it doesn't go to the bank. It doesn't pull money out. In fact, it takes the money it earns on business it's doing now, puts it into the bank, and says the smart thing to do is to wait. Rich people are similar. Rich people earn so much money that they either can't or don't want to spend all of it because they don't need to. They're so wealthy that they can enjoy whatever lifestyle they choose and take a good bit of the money they earn and park it away someplace in a bank. They don't need to go to the bank to borrow. They're rich. In fact, they can save, and they often do, waiting until there's a good opportunity to do something else with their accumulating money. The big savers are corporations and the rich. And the big folks who decide whether to go to the bank and borrow larger quantities of money are likewise corporations in the main and secondarily, occasionally, the rich. But the problem in modern economics are decisions, above all by corporations and the rich, to not participate in the circular flow, to take a part of their income and not spend it for reasons of their own private well-being, of their own private calculations. That's why critics of capitalism say so often, you need to understand that the capitalist system is a system in which the mass of people exist economically dependent on a tiny minority, the heads of major corporations and the wealthiest 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%. Because the decisions those free enterprises and wealthy people make, the decisions about whether or not to spend their money is what will determine whether or not the rest of us have a job, the rest of us earn an income. They don't create jobs. The jobs are created when we have enough income to buy things. Only when goods are sold will employers hire people. So if the employer does the hiring, but the employer only hires if we all have enough with which to buy. It's we with our spending who create the demand and therefore the jobs. If the wealthy and the corporations hold back spending, don't spend goods and services, then the demand isn't there. And we get laid off. And then we have the bad cycle. They hold back. We then get laid off the jobs because there's no point in hiring us to produce the goods that can't be sold because rich people and corporations have held back. Then once we are laid off, we become part of the problem because we don't have income, so we can't spend. So the holding back of the corporations and the rich is expanded because we all, losing our jobs because of their decision, we now can't spend either, plunging yet more people into a loss of jobs, and that's what a recession and a depression are. They are led off, they're initiated by private decisions made by private enterprises for their own purposes, by wealthy people for their own purposes. They don't mean the rest of us any harm, any more than you meant any harm to the bowling establishment when you decided to save some money and not go there. But the harm was done, whether you intended or not. Corporations and the rich are nice folks. That's not the issue. But they're caught in a system where the decisions they make for their own well-being, not to produce if they think the market is not good, to hold back, to buy another mansion if you're rich, the decisions they think they're making by themselves, about themselves, for themselves, have social consequences. That's what it means to live in an economic system like ours. They don't want to be responsible for the consequences of their decisions. But they are responsible. And it's up to us to determine in the end whether we want to have an economic system in which a tiny minority of people can make decisions as if they weren't responsible for the consequences, and we all have to live with those consequences. That, I submit to you, is the problem of the capitalist system. All right, let me turn then the last part of this program to some of your questions. The first one is perhaps the simplest to deal with. One of you writes to me that the official tax rate, federal tax rate on corporations' profits, is 35%. You explain in your letter, in your email, that you understand that many corporations don't pay anything like that. On the other hand, you've been seeing documents that indicate that the average tax rate paid by American corporations is 29%, and it strikes you that that isn't that far down below the 35% that is the official rate. Would I comment on this? And of course I will comment. That's what we have this program for. We encourage you to send in questions, so of course I'm going to respond. We can't, of course, respond to all the questions. We ask you to understand that. We have to select, but we try to select those questions that are similar enough to other people's that we're responding to more than one or two of you when we choose which question to answer. So yes, there is a calculation repeated fairly often that if you look at all the taxes paid by corporations, American corporations, it averages around 29%. But the key word there is all, because that 29% measures what American corporations pay to the federal government, tax obligations, to state governments where they are active and they have tax obligations, to city governments where they are active and they have tax obligations, and to foreign governments. In other words, the 29% is a measure of all the taxes corporations pay, not just to the federal government. The federal government charges 35%, but the average American companies pay to the federal government is closer to 22%, nowhere near the 23%. So how do you get from the 22% that average corporations pay to the federal government to the 29% average across all of it? It's simply the adding of what corporations pay to the states, what corporations pay to cities and towns, and what corporations pay to foreign governments. This is the important thing to understand. So yes, when you add up all the taxes, it's in the neighborhood of 29%. But lest that strike you as somehow bizarre, let me remind you of two things. One, if we add up all the taxes you and I pay, citizens of a capitalist country, we would also have to add not just the federal income tax rate that we pay to the national government, but all of the state taxes we pay in the United States, all of the local property taxes we pay, and any payments we make to foreign governments. Most American citizens don't make payments to foreign governments, but they certainly make enormous payments to state governments, for example, on sales tax every time they buy something, the tax you pay if you own your own home, the property tax in your town, the way the United States is set up. Then there are excise taxes, special, very high taxes on motor fuel, on alcoholic beverages, on tobacco products, and so on. And you put that all together, and the percentage in the United States is much higher than 29%. So corporations actually get the better part of that deal. But the second thing I want to talk to you about, briefly, in terms of taxation, is to remind you of something we have dealt with here, but really cannot be overstressed. And that is that the taxes on corporations here in the United States, like the taxes on the rich, have been drastically cut. The important thing is how badly that has affected the economy and how drastically those taxes have been cut. Cut in ways that the middle and lower income people of the United States haven't imagined, let alone enjoyed. So again, the basic numbers. After the Great Depression, when the economy of the United States was in such terrible trouble because our capitalist system basically collapsed in the 1930s, it was decided that we needed an extensive stimulus. And the war was such a stimulus, World War II, but even afterwards, for decades, we stimulated the economy. Because we had to. And it was felt by the government then, starting with Franklin Roosevelt, the Democrat, but continuing with Democrats and Republicans thereafter, it was felt that wealthy people had to be asked, required, to pay a big high tax to help this national effort to recover from the ravages of a Great Depression plus World War II. And so the income tax on wealthy people was raised to very high levels. Franklin Roosevelt proposed a 100% top rate in 1944. What was that? It was a law proposed by the president, sent to Congress, that every dollar over $25,000 that was earned by any American in 1944 100% would be taxed by the government. In effect, Roosevelt was proposing a maximum income in the United States. Nobody would earn more than $25,000, which would be about $380,000 today. The Republicans, not surprisingly, went ballistic, can't do it, blah, blah. Big struggle, big compromise, 94%. So that became the law. And for much of the 1940s and 50s thereafter, the top income tax bracket was 91% for the richest Americans. Even in the 60s and 70s, it was over 70%. Today, it's 39%. Yeah, it's been dropped by more than half of what it was. Nothing like that was done for the mass of people. Nothing like that. Nothing remotely like that. The mass of people have basically continued to pay the bulk of the taxes, both by the income tax and by the shift over to a payroll tax afterwards. They enjoyed no such cut. Ditto, corporations had their taxes cut over the last 40 years drastically. So the reason we have our difficulties in our society is that over the last several decades, taxes on corporations and the rich have been really cut drastically, and that's the end of the story. That's why all the governments are in trouble. It's not that they've expanded their output so much as they have crushed their own sources of revenue. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank you again for your coming to this program, and I really look forward to talking with you again next week on Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. Time now, baby. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, baby. Thing ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.